Okay, well, thanks for inviting me to give this talk. And actually, I won't be focusing on the deep mantle, as it says in the title, but actually the whole mantle. But like Torsten, I'll start by showing a movie of simulation of mantle convection with plate tectonics, this time with continents. So it will start moving soon. Actually, first rotate it. So this looks remarkably like the Earth. All the continents are there in the correct positions. Of course, that's because Tobias Rolf, who made this movie, put them in the correct positions. But so this is, in a way, a prediction of the future Earth. It's what the continents and the plates will do next. But anyway, it shows the type of calculations that we can do nowadays. We have subduction zones like this and spreading centers, and they're generated self-consistently by the rheology, as also in the example that Torsten showed. So the only thing that's imposed is the initial condition here. Everything else is evolving self-consistently. And this model, however, is a bit lacking because it doesn't contain any compositional variations except for the continent. And that'll be a theme of my talk, is thermochemical convection. So I'll start by showing a number of cartoons to illustrate various concepts. And then I'll focus a bit on the early Earth as a contrast to the present day Earth. And, you know, because the structure of the mantle today is a sort of integral of, you know, what's been happening over billions of years. So we need to consider the whole sort of history of the Earth, not just what's happening today. So that's anyway my excuse for showing some results relevant to the early Earth. And then I'll, different possible origins of heterogeneity are, one is recycled crust and the other is primordial material, and I'll show some examples of models of both of those examples, or both of those possibilities. Well, so when we consider the mantle, we should consider compositional variations as well as thermal variations for various reasons. One is that compositional variations are observed in outcrops of mantle rocks. You know, you get these different layers at the scale of tens of centimeters. Compositional variations are observed in geochemistry, looking at trace element compositions of erupted magmas. They find different end members. In seismology, this is by now a sort of old model, but this was an attempt to invert for thermal density variations and compositional density variations. And you notice the amplitude is similar between the two. So according to this inversion, and no doubt there are more recent ones now, the sort of amplitude of density variations due to compositional variations is comparable to that of thermal variations in the mantle. So there have been various, you know, conceptual models of the chemical structure of the mantle. Some of these, I think, can be ruled out. They're not really contenders nowadays. But anyway, so there are different types of material. The purple is primitive or primordial. The green is the depleted Morb mantle. And then there's recycled crust, which is in this color. So there have been different possibilities. One is that there's just a layer of anomalous material at the bottom, or maybe a larger undulating layer, or maybe, you know, plums of primordial material, which is sort of related to what these beams that Maxime is proposing. Anyway, so it's all very well to come up with lots of cartoons, but we need to test them with dynamical models. Another thing, a possibility that was proposed in 2007 by Stefan and colleagues, was this basal magma ocean that you would have had melting at the bottom. Well, if you started with a global deep magma ocean, then it would have crystallized from the sort of mid-lower mantle in both directions, and the basal magma ocean could survive potentially for up to billions of years and explain even the ULVZs today, whereas the surficial magma ocean cools much more rapidly because it's exposed to the surface. And then there have been other concepts proposed for generating major element and trace element heterogeneity. There's the transition zone water filter, which is a way of trapping water and incompatible trace elements in the transition zone. These upside down differentiation idea, which is that you would actually, in the early Earth, when the mantle was hotter, you could get partial melting, you know, deep in the mantle, particularly in the transition zone. And then you would have this sort of internal differentiation that is not related to the formation of crust. You know, today we think of the formation of crust as being the main differentiation mechanism, but early on when it was hotter, you would have had other mechanisms potentially. So possibly many of these mechanisms are or were operating at the same time. So I think it's probably not a good idea just to focus on one thing and propose that this explains everything. And so we attempted to combine several of these mechanisms. So in the early Earth, perhaps there was, we expect a thicker basaltic crust because the potential temperature of the mantle was hotter. You could have had internal melting and internal partial melting creating differentiation. And some of these differentiated products would end up at the bottom, perhaps joining a basal magma ocean, and ending up with a sort of mixture of stuff at the bottom, which I called a basal melange, or BAM for short. So probably shouldn't focus on one mechanism. And then fast forward to the present day, you know, this mixture of materials that built up over time could explain the LLSVPs, and there's still ongoing differentiation associated with oceanic crust production and subduction. So we have run lots of models in which partial melting produces oceanic crust, and then this is subducted and builds up at various places in the mantle. Sometimes you can get it building up at the bottom. It also builds up in the transition zone, something that Maxime will focus on more tomorrow. And so this is one way of generating heterogeneity, but it also has some other implications. And Diogo looked at these a few years ago. So what's happening here then is this is a typical geotherm, this is the solidus, and here you can get partial melting, and in some of our models we remove any partial melt immediately and turn it into crust. So you can generate basaltic crust when the temperature exceeds the solidus below the lithosphere. And Diogo found that this actually helps produce plate tectonics. So model A here is a model with just a isochemical, so just a purely thermal model, and it does not develop plate tectonics. For 4.5 billion years, it's a stagnant lid planet. Whereas when this melting and crustal production is introduced, then the model displays episodic plate tectonics. So it has bursts of plate tectonics, in other words, where the whole lithosphere overturns. So this is interesting that it's not the partial melt itself that's helping in this case, it's the production of a variable thickness crust that produces additional stresses that helps break the lithosphere and produce plate tectonics. And yes, Diogo made some nice regime diagrams. This is yield stress, this is something else, viscosity, and adding melting and crustal production shifts the regime boundaries to the right, which means to higher yield stresses. So that allows you to get episodic or mobile lithosphere behavior at higher yield stresses. So in a way, yes, partial melt does help plate tectonics, but not by the direct mechanical effect of the melt itself. But those models assume that all of the melt generated below the plates went to produce basaltic crust. However, in nature, in the Earth, it's thought that a lot of the melt that's produced goes to intrusive magmatism instead of extrusive magmatism. And this is expected to have a quite different mechanical effect, because when you keep putting cold basalt on the top and then burying it with more cold basalt, you end up with a cold crust and lithosphere. And cold tends to be strong. Whereas if you keep injecting hot magma into the crust, then this will tend to warm up the crust. So here we expect a warm, weak crust. So this is expected to have quite different dynamics, and it does. So these are models by Diogo. Here's one with purely extrusive magmatism, and you see that there was a sort of burst of subduction. This is composition here, so red is crust, this is temperature, this is viscosity, and this is melt. So, and then, what we're seeing is bursts of subduction, and then it's stagnant for a while, and then you get another burst. This is the time in billions of years. And there is a secular change. So actually, towards the end, you get more continuous subduction. Now we're getting more frequent subduction events, and by the end, it'll settle into almost steady subduction as the mantle cools and sort of balance of stresses changes. Yes. Okay, but now compare that to a model in which 90% of the melt produced intrudes into the lithosphere at the base of the crust. Well, now you will see much more continuous behavior. So it doesn't display this episodicity, you're going from stagnant to then overturn, but instead you're getting sort of drips off the base of the lithosphere all the time. And that's because this intrusion of melt into the lithosphere is making it weak. And where the basalt becomes thick enough to turn to ectogite, then it becomes unstable and it tends to drip to the bottom. So quite different dynamics caused by just a different assumption about what happens to partial melt below the lithosphere. And so this turns out to be a new regime. When you plot a regime diagram, this is yield stress versus extrusion rate, you find this regime that I just showed, which we've named plutonic squishy lid, actually doesn't depend on the value of the yield stress. So this can take place even if you don't have any plastic yielding in your model. And here's Antoine Rozel's cartoon to explain what's happening. So what happens is that you get melt in sort of intruded into the lithosphere, not everywhere at the same time, but in certain places, and that weakens those places. And then you can get sort of lateral motion of regions of the lithosphere accommodated by these weak zones caused by melt intrusion. Now, so we think this is relevant to the early Earth. It's not relevant to today's Earth, but it would be relevant to the early Earth when there was a lot more magmatism than there is today. And previously, people have done studies, people like Jeroen van Hoonen, showing that subduction wouldn't work or wouldn't have worked in early Earth. So this is a successful model of subduction which represents today, but when you try running the same model with a higher ambient temperature, like 100, 200, or 300 degrees, then the subduction doesn't continue. You just sort of the slab breaks off, and then the subduction stops. So we propose that this plutonic squishy lid mode is what happened in early Earth when the mantle was hotter before subduction took place. And this is also supported by regional models. So Taras and Elena and other co-workers have run and are running models like this, representing the early Earth. This is just the top 200 kilometers, not the whole planet, but you do get partially molten asthenosphere, you get the partially molten crust, and you get all this dripping of the lower crust that we also saw in the global models. So the fact that you get something similar in very well-resolved regional models gives us some confidence that the global models are reasonable. Now, another thing that was happening early on is impacts. So it is thought that perhaps 1% of the mass of the Earth was added after its main accretion by impacts, and that this might have occurred as a late heavy bombardment. So there are these models that have been proposed. This is Morbidelli et al. Model. This is 4.5 billion years ago, 3.5 billion years ago. And there was an initial sort of decrease in the number of impactors, and then an increase about 4 billion years ago, the late heavy bombardment. And the late heavy bombardment added the late veneer, which is something that geochemists like to talk about. So But what is the mechanical effect of all of these impacts? And this is from Marchi et al. This is the sort of location of the impactors or the impact craters 3.5 billion years ago. So according to this, the number of impactors, well, this sort of looks like the surface of the moon. It's completely saturated by impacts. And so all of these impactors must have had some mechanical and thermal effect on the early Earth. And so this was explored by Craig O'Neill very nicely in 2017. He published 2D models. We have been running 3D models. And so this is a 500 million year interval. On the left, you see a model with no impacts, and on the right, you see a model with impacts taking place. See, that's what these circles are. So in the left model, nothing much is happening. The crust is gradually thickening. But in the right-hand model, with a reasonable sort of distribution of impactors coming in, there's a lot happening. You see, in fact, some movement of, you see some subduction, you see some lateral movement of regions looking like plate tectonics. See, this is before the late heavy bombardment. Then it suddenly, you said, get this sudden increase. And what we're looking here actually is at the is the compositional field. So, yes. So we definitely see some sort of short-lived plate tectonics induced by impact. And let's look at this movie now. And maybe the thing to focus on is this, the strain rate. So this is the strain rate in the outer part of the planet. And yes, every time there's an impact, you get some high strain rate events and things moving around. So it seems, you know, that this should definitely be, or was definitely a factor in the early Earth, sort of the first billion years of Earth evolution. And if we want to understand early Earth tectonics, we should include the effect of impacts in our models. You sometimes hear this view of early Earth as being that the lithosphere was basically rigid, nothing was happening, and then we had to think of some reason why plate tectonics started. But according to the models I've been showing here, you know, the early Earth was actually very dynamic. There was lots of magmatism. The magma was weakening the lithosphere and enabling it to deform and move around. And impacts were doing the same thing. So we don't really need any sort of special mechanisms to start subduction early on. There was a lot going on. Another point here, actually, is that after the impacts die out, the planet goes back to being a stagnant lid. So, you know, it's not that the Earth was sort of waiting, just waiting for some kick to start plate tectonics. It's getting plenty of kicks here, but plate tectonics doesn't survive after the impacts have stopped. But, of course, this depends on the assumed value of yield stress. So impact can certainly break a stagnant lid, giving temporary mobility and subduction, but when the impacts stop, a stagnant lid returns if, you know, the system wants to be stagnant lid. So you can't just force plate tectonics this way. But if it's anyway mobile lid behavior, then these impacts don't make that much difference to the averaged dynamics. So moving on now to the long-term evolution, we have run a lot of models with production of basaltic crust that can then be subducted and often builds up at the bottom. And a key point is that this subducted crust at the bottom, plus any material that was there from the beginning, greatly influence the geodynamo. So just to refer to the most recent Nakagawa and me paper. So here we have a model with only basalt, that some of which segregates at the bottom, as has happened in various models since 1994. And this focuses on the evolution of the core. Okay, so this is the core mantle boundary temperature. The core cools as heat is taken out of it. This is the inner core size. And yeah, in these models, the core cools too quickly. And in fact, in some models, the core becomes completely solid because it cools so much. So, and this is a general problem in these models where you're tracking core evolution. If you just have thermal convection, then it's difficult to stop the core from cooling too much over geological history. And so, at least in these models, it's really necessary to have a compositional layer at the bottom made of subducted basalt or primordial material or some combination of the two, as in these models, to reduce the heat flux and allow the geodynamo to continue over geological history without freezing the whole core. So these models have a combination of a dense primordial layer, shown in red here, and subducted basalt. And in these models, we can obtain realistic present-day core temperature and inner core size. So finally, let's talk about the influence of the viscosity of these possible piles of dense material above the core mantle boundary, which may be present in LLSVPs. So I'll just highlight a couple results from a couple of papers, one by Langer, Meyer, Lohmann, and myself, one by Yang Li, Frederick Deschamps, some other people who I don't have photographs of, and yes. So, well, you might... 5 minutes? 2 minutes? Okay, yes. Wonder why there should be a viscosity difference of this material, and, well, firstly, it's hot down there, so just from temperature, we would expect it to have a lower viscosity, but it may also have an intrinsic compositional density difference, perhaps because of its different composition, different water content, different iron content, different grain size. The grains can grow. So one can make several arguments why the viscosity might be different intrinsically. And then, so let's look at some models. Here's a composition, dense material. Here's temperature. So we'll be looking at different density contrasts. When the density contrast is less, the topography of these piles is higher, as is well known. And this is showing the effect of viscosity contrast from 0.1 to 30. And it doesn't have a huge influence on the morphology and topography, but it does have one that you can notice. Basically, when the intrinsic viscosity is higher, then you cannot get internal convection within these piles, whereas here you do get internal circulation in the piles. And then, so they become hotter, basically, and less stable. And if you're close to the stability threshold, this means that they can actually, go unstable and disappear. Yes. Another point from these calculations, as well as others that people have published, is that the piles don't stay in the same place for billions of years. Instead, they sort of move around, they're influenced by subduction, they can split up, join together, and so on. This is also shown by these 3D models, which span a time period of 1 billion years. You see the piles sort of moving around, changing, splitting up, merging. Yes. So I'll just make the final point that this viscosity contrast also has a substantial influence on the core mantle boundary heat flux. Now, this is a busy graph that shows the influence of three different parameters, but focus on the colors which show the viscosity contrast. And this is basal heat flux. And the blue points, these are the ones with the low viscosity dense material, have the higher CMB heat flux. So this is important for the evolution of the core, for the long-term evolution of the Earth. So just to summarize, likely, at the bottom of the mantle, any piles are likely to be a mixture of materials, not a single thing. Early Earth, we think something like this plutonic squishy lid dynamics, also impacted by impacts. Piles of dense material at the CMB have a strong influence on CMB heat flux and may even be needed to explain the evolution of the geodynamo, and the actual viscosity of these piles does influence the heat flux and their stability. Okay, thank you.